Accession number 19057, Reel 4.
Reel 4, Ernie Leopard.
Yeah, we was in this basement cellar, and during the day, one or two more tanks were knocked out, and their crews come back into the cellar with us about 4 or 5 o'clock. Some major come round to us and told us we'd have to stay there overnight. There's a major battle going on in Cleve. The town hadn't been taken, and the sheriffs were engaging almost a rodeo, chasing Germans around the town. He said he wanted a German arms cache blown up, told us where our first aid post was, because we had a few slightly wounded, and he brought rum ration round, so things looked a bit brighter then. We battened down this hatch because during the night the Germans in the Reichswald Forest were coming back through Cleve, presumably to pick up arms from this arms cache, which we blew up with the Germans' Panzerfausts and some of their stick grenades. And they was chucking grenades down the cellars because they knew British were about in some of the cellars, but we had a fright about, I think it was about 4 o'clock in the morning. A track vehicle was about, so we, wandering about upside, wondering whether it was a German tank had come in, so we crept up, but it was our German Sherman bulldozer wandering about at night. But there we stayed till morning. It was a bit distressing. One of our chaps had come completely bomb-happy off his rocker, and we had a job to keep him quiet. He was crying and screaming, and his tank had got hit, and I think he was slightly wounded, but he had gone off his head. Anyway, next morning, we rescued some rations from our tank, which was just across the road. Unloaded the Browning, spiked the gun. Well, removed the firing pin. And I was a bit annoyed because I had some loot in the turret, which I forgot about. But anyway, the sun major come round about midday. We'd have to move quickly as German defences had flooded the road from Nijmegen to Cleve, and it was under about 4 foot of water, so we come in by tanks and went out by boat.
What had happened to the body of your co-driver?
Our padre, Reverend Skinner, wrote a book, The Man Who Worked on Sundays, and his job apparently was to dig out the dead bodies, bury them, and make records. And he's written a book of the records, and he had dug him out during the day and buried him with two or three others in the action. And he's recorded it in his book, Trooper W. Davis, buried at such and such a spot, and the map location, I think it was Trooper Valentine and somebody else had got killed on that action. But he had gone back. He was with Regimental Headquarters, who were the second unit after B Squadron, our squadron, to come into Cleve, and they were involved in this hectic rodeo in Cleve, unusual for HQ to get involved in a tank battle, but good luck to them. Anyway, we were ferried back to Nijmegen, and as the road was flooded, we were told to lose ourselves for 4 days.
So what did you do?
Well, found a bakery. We had no bread rations, so when we was in Nijmegen last, October, November, we'd found a bakery and located it. So we made that our billet for two or three days. The Dutch people we had plenty of cigarettes, so they smuggled us out to out-of-bounds cafes, and we had quite a good time for 4 days. A few drinks, and funny enough, I didn't drink then. But it was quite good. But Nijmegen was still being shelled, and they had V1s and V2s in Nijmegen, so it was all a bit, flashes and that. But then after 4 days, they'd come round and told us we had tanks to go back into Cleve, reform and go back into Cleve. But my driver, Bill Kendrick, and the gunner, Arthur Faulkner, we've been trying to get rid of him for a long time. They come up, shook my hands and said, we'll never see them again, they'd had enough. And I never did. And I never knew how they got out of the bloody regiment. But I don't think they deserted. They got themselves down into Echelon and got themselves out the regiment, out of action. But I never did see them again.
So did you reform with the new crew?
Yeah. The new crew was the same tank commander. Actually, him and Sergeant Roberts have found themselves a brothel. They had been for 4 days, but don't tell anybody that. But a new crew was Bert Tye, who come from Worcester, as driver. He was an elderly type. He was another one who didn't consider himself considered himself as a non-combatant driver only. And our gunner, Bill Ashton, who lived at Ashford in Kent, but I never come across them again after the war. So we went back down to Nijmegen, went back from Nijmegen to Cleve. But this time, our new tank was a 17-pounder. None of us had been on a 17-pounder before, so we had a few days to learn how the bloody thing worked. But
so what's the difference between the normal Sherman and the 17-pounder?
Well, the 17-pounder was a much bigger gun. It was the armour-piercing gun. It was level with the German Panther tank. The 75 millimetre was a much shorter barrelled. The shells were only about 75. The shells were only 2 foot. That was the shell, and the cartridge was 2 foot. The 17-pounder was over 3 foot long with a much bigger propellant, and it fired, the 75 fired about 2,800 feet, and I think the 17-pounder did about 4,000 feet. And 17-pounder go through armour, whereas the 75 would just bounce off the German tanks.
Was the whole troop equipped?
No, one per troop. So I went back as a corporal tank in the 17-pounder. Well, the 17-pounder, a lot of them didn't like going in them because the Germans always went for the 17-pounders first, to knock them out first. And they weren't supposed to lead, but we was being the corporal, the lowest rank in the troop, tank commander in the troop, he was always getting pushed in the front, which he shouldn't have done, but he was. But anyway, I liked it because the 75, if it got hit, the tank commander's got to get out, then the gunner, and then the wireless operator got to crawl underneath the gun to get out after those two. The 17-pounder, because it was such a large breach inside the turret, the co-driver and wireless operator, and loader had his own hatch, so for the rest of the war, I had a 17-pounder, and my head was outside in the tank, seeing what was going on, more than it was inside. And, on a 17-pounder, you know, the tank commander is watching the action in front, and if you got another one looking out the turret to look him round the area as well, it's a bonus in when you're going into action.
What was your opinion of the Sherman?
Bloody awful. It wouldn't stop anything. Well, as I said, when we was at Heinsberg, 0.5 bullet was known to go through the armour plate. But they couldn't stop anything.
I've heard they were prone to catching fire.
They were, mostly in the desert, because this is an anecdote, I suppose. At Alamein, the Americans stripped a whole armoured regiment to supply the 8th Army with Sherman tanks, 300 Sherman tanks supplied to the 8th Army at Alamein. They were obsolete. They was radials. They worked on high-octane petrol. And they were called Ronson lighters because they stunk of petrol. A slightest spark, they went up in flame. That's where the name of Ronsons come from. But the diesels, diesel Shermans and the Chrysler, only if something come through and hit an actual cartridge, your shell stacked up, would they go up. There wasn't petrol fumes in like the earlier Shermans were.
So with a 17-pounder Sherman, you were meant to engage German tanks. Was that its role?
The 17-pounder, its role was to, as an anti-tank gun, you were to engage the enemy tanks. You also had high explosives, so you could fire a longer distance and engage a bigger distance. You had better sights too. But you fired one shot and then you was completely blind because the flash, you couldn't see. So every time you fired, you blinked your eyes to get rid of the flash, otherwise you wouldn't see for two or three, you know, seconds for the next shot. But that 17-pounder, I liked it.
So what happened after you returned to Cleve?
Cleve, we was there for about 10 days, reforming, because the whole squadron was only down to 6 tanks, and our establishment was 20 tanks of 4 troops of 4 and HQ tanks. Reformed, and then we engaged with the I thought it was the 53rd Wessex we was engaged, 53rd Welsh Regiment we was engaged at Gok, Wies and Isham. Those three, we supported the 53rd Welsh Division. And the next action was just outside Gok. Rather peculiar, because my gunner was complaining that the gun wasn't firing properly. It wasn't TNA'd, you know, tested and adjusted the firing sights. And the driver was complaining that the battery was running short on it, so there was something wrong with it. But over Loch and Gok, we all lined up over the town of Gok, and we tested the gun on a church steeple in Gok, and got the gun right. But the next action, going down into Gok, we got to a wooded area. It was a Hochwald layback defence line. But this particular area, it was in a wooded area, almost a square area, diagonally as a hill going over it. We had 11 runners in the squadron at the time, formed up in the top corner. Germans shelled us while we was forming up, and then we Germans were holding this farmhouse in the far corner. It was urgent that we got pushed on, so we were all lined up and were to go over the brow of this hill and down toward this farmhouse. whoever gave this cockeyed order wanted shooting himself, I think, because the Sherman couldn't fire on the move, so you go over the brow of the hill, and the infantry got to the brow of the hill, and three or four Spando machine guns opened up at them, so they lay flat, and then we to go over in one charge, top speed, to get at this farmhouse. Well, we go over, just reach the brow, and there's a German Panther tank in the corner, and he's firing all along the line, and the shells whipping. We could see the shells whipping up, and the chap on the left, he got to the farmhouse, but they come out with bazookas and hit his tank with a bazooka. The next tank, the Panther tank in the corner, straight on up, this shell straight on through him, buried in his engine. They bailed out, but it, funny enough, the tank didn't catch fire. Two or three others got hit, and then we was more or less on the right, and our driver was in a panic. He put his foot down and charged into some woods on the right-hand side, and he didn't take his bloody foot off the accelerator. We charged into the wood, hit a tree. Everything come down with a clatter. He had knocked himself out. The gun skewed round, and everything went dead. The complete tank went completely dead, and a load of acrid smoke come out inside it, so we all bowed out, thought we'd been hit, and outside it was bloody sight worse than it was inside. I was mortaring and machine gunning us, so we jumped back in. And we found that it wasn't till later we had to chop a tree down to hand crank the gun round to face this farmhouse. We later found that every time we traversed the tank, a piece of metal underneath the turret was brushing the battery terminals, and that was our problem, shorting out the batteries, and it completely shorted out everything. So there we were. We fired the gun a bit, and then they put in another attack on the farmhouse, took the farmhouse, and then it was about evening, and again everybody had disappeared and just left us. And we were completely dead, no radio. It was getting dark. We didn't want to go wandering about in the dark, so we slept inside a tank that night, and about 2 o'clock, our driver said, "There's a bloody Germans outside and knocking at the tank." And we heard the word surrender, and I think we was that low morale. If they'd been asked to surrender, we would have done, but they was wishing to surrender. So
it was Germans knocking on the tank to surrender.
So we bloody annoyed getting woke up that time of morning, and made a cup of tea, and we was running short of rations, and we didn't want to feed them, so we took their arms off them and sent them across the field, and they'd find some infantry over there. In fact, we didn't want them at all. And after that gone, Johnny said to me, "Did you see their uniforms?" I said, "No, why?" He said, "They're bloody tank uniforms they was wearing, you know, the black wrap over tunics the tank crews wore." He said, "I bet they was from that bloody tank that knocked us out. I'm glad we got rid of them." And next morning, we walked over to the farmhouse, got contact with somebody to ring up radio regiment, our armoured recovery vehicle. They come round with a and pull us out and get us started again. So they couldn't get round to the next day. Well, they come round later on today. They came round later on the day, but they didn't have a spare battery. So he said that we'd have to stay another night. But in the meantime, we've wandered about. We was getting short of rations. The second tank that had got knocked out, the crew had all disappeared. They had a complete intact ration pack, 4-day ration pack. So we was all right for rations then.
What was in the 4-day ration pack?
Enough to last a crew of 5 4-days. You know, sweets, bacon, self-heating soup. Enough for a crew to survive for 4 days. In fact, we lived on the ration packs and cigarettes in there, sweets and bacon, powdered egg, McConaughey soup. Anything you like in there. Things we did like were, jam puddings and things like that. Anyway, the chap who got knocked out on the left, I've researched this and did an article for the Regimental magazine last year. He was a Corporal Turner. He had his legs off by the bazooka. And I wrote this article last year about it and said Ginger Turner was injured and his crew member, Johnny Darcy, had been killed. And funny enough, his daughter rang me. She was so pleased to know that how her father, she had been searching for 50 years to find how her father had got killed, and nobody had ever been able to tell her.
Was this the tank that had charged across towards the farmhouse and had been hit by the bazooka?
That's right, yeah. The Germans defended in the farmhouse, hit him by a bazooka. But that all gone, and I looked at the tank. It was a blackened mess inside. But the second one, I'd got the ration pack. We went back. We stayed another night. And this time, we could sleep outside the tank with a tarpaulin because the action had gone. And then we was talking at night. I said, did you look at the battery at the tank knocked out across the house? I said, no, never give it a thought. We'll have a look at it in the morning. So next morning we went across and the battery was still all right. So we took the battery out, took it back to our tank, charged it up and we start our engine, got everything going. By about midday, we weren't in any hurry to get going anywhere. Our ARV come up with a spare battery and we was going, what the bloody hell you call us out for, stupid buggers. Anyway, you go down this lane and you come onto the main road into Gok, and the regiment's in Gok. Well, we go down this lane, about 100 yards, and there's this Panther tank that had hit us the night before. It had lost its track, and behind it was another one, completely intact. Nothing wrong with it. We spent half an hour or so looking over it, and they must have just run out of petrol.
What was your opinion of the Panther?
Oh, it was a marvellous tank. I mean, there was 11 of us went over the hill, and there it was picking us off. And you see the shells whipping up, and we had no answer to them. We couldn't see where they was coming from. They was hidden behind a gate that led into a sunken lane going out the lane we followed. But it was marvellous. But they, one thing about these Panther tanks, they weren't Panther tanks. They were Jag Panthers. That was a very sloping, glassy front, and then the gun was fixed and it could only go 15 degrees. So if we'd known, they couldn't have picked all 11 of us off, because they couldn't, to move their gun, that to move the whole bloody tank. So they only picked off about, I think they hit about 5 of our tanks. Anyway, there was about 7 of our chaps killed in that action, and a few wounded. Then we got into Gok, and we had we was reforming again. that's a continual thing. You'd have an action, you get into town, come out of action, start reforming. We was taken out, I think it was out for about a week in Gok. We got into a muse house right opposite the church, which we had TNA'd our guns on a couple of days previously. But apparently in the crypt, all the Germans were living in these crypt, in the crypt of this church. So they were still in, some Germans were still in the town, but we took over a muse house. It had an Arga cooker in the kitchen, which I scrounged some flour, and I was doing fruit pies for a couple of days, which we lived very well. And then come from Cleve now. It had been a couple of weeks, so I hadn't had a bath, so thought the bath wasn't coming round till the next day, so I got as much cans as I could, took a timber up to the first floor, which was, you know, someone's decent drawing room with a carpet, but it was, you know, bomb damaged in it, no windows, and made myself a bath, got in the bath. In the middle of the bath, there was two women standing in the room. That was the first time I'd come in contact with German civilians all since we'd entered Germany. Sudden shock. I was reaching for a revolver and they just disappeared. But, I'm going to say, what the bloody hell are you doing here? We was there two or three days, and we changed troops then. My troop tank commander had been trying to get back into his old troop sergeant's troop. You know, he'd been his driver right from D-Day. So we was the corporal tank in another troop, third troop.
What troop had you been in previously?
First troop. I'd actually been in fifth troop at the Hongan operation with a new, when we had a new Bright Spark as a troop leader, but he had gone when he got wounded. And we was there in Cleve. We was in first troop, the leading troop into Cleve. And I was now in third troop. And the next action